The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. The Harvard Health Letter, Digital Health Tracking, Preventive Care or Privacy Invasion. 24-hour health monitoring is high-tech, but is it helpful? The day has arrived when doctors can remotely monitor your health every moment, if you and they choose. Increasing numbers of wireless digital sensors, some implanted in or on the body, some ingested, and some worn like clothing, are making the leap from patients to patients. In 2017, the FDA cleared dozens of devices for continuous health monitoring. The hope is that people heading towards serious problems such as high blood sugar or heart rhythm abnormalities can be headed off at the press, explains Dr. Anthony Komaroff, the editor of the Harvard Health Letter. Not necessarily new. We've had portable gadgets that monitor health for decades. One early example is the kind of heart pacemaker that detects irregular heartbeats and shocks them back to a normal rhythm. Today, we also have devices that sense and respond to many other health problems, such as Parkinson's disease, tremors, or pauses in breathing during sleep. But, at least until recently, these devices didn't report information to the doctor at the moment they were called into action. That's been changing. The new monitors. Many gadgets now can wirelessly transmit data to your doctor's office, often by using your smartphone. Some devices, like a pacemaker, monitor and affect a particular body function. Others track basic health information, such as your activity level, blood sugar level, heart and respiratory rates, skin temperature, posture, and even falls. These new generation sensors may be implanted in the body, such as a tiny monitor the size of a pencil tip that detects abnormal heartbeats 24 hours a day. Applied to the skin as a patch, also called electronic skin or a smart tattoo, that looks like an adhesive bandage embedded inside are flat, flexible electronics that measure vital signs such as temperature. Worn as clothing, such as socks, with special heat sensors that can detect foot ulcers as soon as they begin to develop, or contact lenses that may one day monitor blood sugar and tears. Also on the horizon, orthopedic sensors that can tell doctors how well a hip, knee, or spinal implant is fusing with bone or coping with pressure. Digital pills. The latest monitoring development came in November 2017 when the FDA approved the first digital pill. Each pill is embedded with an ingestible sensor that records when the drug is taken and then sends the information to a wearable patch. The patch can forward the data to your smartphone, caregivers, and doctors. The approved medication with this technology is Abilify MyCIT, which is MyCITE, which contains aripiprazole, an antipsychotic drug used to treat schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, or sometimes adult depression. But the approval of a digital pill opens the door for many other types of medications that could have tracking applications. Benefits. Imagine getting a call from your doctor's office alerting you about a missed dose of medication, an abnormal heart rhythm, or a dangerously high blood sugar level. If we're able to diagnose and treat you earlier, prevent emergencies, or predict whether you need to go to the doctor, that can potentially improve health and save money, says Dr. Amit Sarpatwari, a Harvard Medical School instructor who researches pharmaceutical policy. Indeed, there have been many reports that digital health monitors have helped identify problems that doctors had not previously diagnosed, such as atrial fibrillation. But we don't have enough evidence yet to show if these devices ultimately save lives or money. Some of them cost tens of thousands of dollars, including the hospital costs for implanting them when necessary. As purely diagnostic tools, they do have some value, especially the implantable versions. But we really need more data to see if this information improves outcomes, says Dr. Deepak L. Bhatt, a cardiologist and editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. We also don't have enough evidence that digital pills improve medication adherence. There are many reasons why people don't take their medication. The digital pill addresses only one component of a complex problem, says Dr. Sarpatwari. Health monitoring concerns. Despite the potential to help your health, many concerns remain about digital monitors and pills, such as the chance a device will fail to transmit data, or the extra burden of dealing with the information. Physicians can get inundated. You need enough staff to process it, says Dr. Suzanne Salomon, a geriatrician and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. The technology also raises ethical questions, especially when it comes to digital pills. Will your insurer pay for them if it sees that you're not taking them exactly as prescribed? Will an insurer lower your copay if you agree to take the digital pill? Will the insurer refuse to give you medication unless it can be monitored? As for wireless devices, they create new kinds of information for your medical record. The privacy issues that apply to data from wireless monitoring devices are the same as those for your other health information. Who will have access to this information? And will insurers and employers be able to pressure you to be monitored if you have a health condition that might benefit from monitoring? There are also risks that hackers could illegally assess your information and steal your identity, or worse, render an implanted device inoperable. A lot to grapple with. Are these monitors protecting our health or permitting intrusion? That's a decision each of us must make. I'd probably consider it a protection, says Dr. Komaroff. And given the degree to which people have allowed their personal privacy to be eroded in the world of social networks, I'll bet that's the decision most people make. But whatever decision people make, the point is that it should be their right to decide. Ask the Doctor by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who's editor-in-chief. Why do I almost have an underactive thyroid? My doctor said I, quote, almost, unquote, have an underactive thyroid, which puzzled me. Then she said I might benefit from treatment, which puzzled me more. How can you almost have a disease, and how can treatment be useful if you don't have the disease? Answer, I can see how that might have been confusing. In fairness, it's a confusing situation even for doctors. Let's take this in two parts. First, what's an underactive thyroid? The thyroid gland in our neck makes a hormone called thyroid hormone that travels throughout the body and affects every cell. If it is making the right amount of the hormone, if the blood levels are normal, then there's no problem. If it's making too much, an overactive thyroid, or if it's making too little, an underactive thyroid, those are problems that require treatment. We used to have one blood test to tell if a person has it. Had a normal overactive or underactive thyroid. However, the test had its limitations, so a second blood test was developed. The newer test measures whether the brain thinks the thyroid hormone levels are normal. Usually the results of the two tests point in the same direction, both say normal, overactive, or underactive. But sometimes the two tests give different answers. The newer test says underactive, but the older test says normal. Doctors call this subclinical hypothyroidism, and I'm pretty sure that's what your doctor thinks you have. It's quite common. Nearly 20% of people ages 65 or older, particularly women, have it. And some of these people also have symptoms that could be caused by an underactive thyroid gland, such as fatigue, constipation, feeling cold, slowed movements and speech, and unexplained weight gain. Second, does treatment help in people with subclinical hypothyroidism? In 2017, the results of a large randomized trial covering over 700 people with this condition, ages 65 and older, were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Some received thyroid hormone and others received placebo pills, and neither they nor their doctors knew what they'd been given. Over the next year, the people who received thyroid hormone had symptoms and quality of life similar to those who received the placebo. In other words, the treatment produced no apparent benefit. It also caused no apparent adverse effects, at least for the year of the study. This study shows that the average person with subclinical hypothyroidism does not benefit from thyroid hormone pills. Perhaps future studies will focus on patients with more severe symptoms, since it is possible that treatment might benefit them. For now, it's just one more important thing that doctors don't know and need to know through research. Is your pillow hurting your health? Pillows can help or hurt depending on their firmness and your sleep position. You probably know someone who won't leave home without a special pillow, claiming that a particular bag of fluff or feathers is the key to a good night's sleep, and that person may be on to something. Anything that will make you more comfortable will improve the likelihood of getting a good night's sleep, says Dr. Lawrence Epstein, a sleep expert at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. But the benefits of pillows don't go much further than comfort and positioning. Sometimes pillows even hurt your health. Pillows and pain. If your neck is bent in any way for an extended period of time, you'll get uncomfortable, explains Matthew O'Rourke, a physical therapist at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. He says a pillow that's too soft or too firm often leads to neck pain. For example, if you sleep on your side with a soft pillow, that doesn't provide enough support under your neck. Your head has to extend sideways to meet the pillow. If you sleep on your stomach, a position that hyperextends the neck backward, then using a firm pillow pushes the head back even further. If you're on your stomach with your head to the side, you're sleeping in a full rotation position, and that can become painful, O'Rourke says. Likewise, sleeping on your back with too much firm support pushes the neck far too forward. Pillows can derail CPAP. For people who have sleep apnea, a condition in which you stop breathing periodically during sleep, pillows can interfere with continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, treatment. CPAP keeps your airway open by means of a bedside device that pushes air through a mask while you sleep. If you're a side sleeper, that the pillow can knock the mask off, says Dr. Epstein. Sleep deprivation. Excuse me. Losing sleep from being uncomfortable at night has consequences. Your body has less time for muscle growth, tissue repair, and other important functions that occur during sleep. Sleep deprivation can affect mood, thinking skills, and appetite. Chronic sleep deprivation increases your risk for falls, obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease. On the plus side, special pillows can help stave off some problems such as heartburn symptoms. Among lifestyle changes, elevating the head to 30 degrees can be effective. I've had success with patients using a wedge pillow, says Dr. James Mayika, the sleep lab director at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehab Hospital. Sleeping with your upper body elevated at an angle can also reduce symptoms of sinus problems and may prevent relapses of benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, a condition in which tiny crystals in the inner ear become dislodged and cause extreme dizziness. Specially designed pillows can help people keep their CPAP masks on. They have cutouts that the mask fits into so it won't get knocked off, Dr. Epstein explains. Beware pillow promises. While adjusting your sleep position can help stave off symptoms, it won't eliminate health problems such as restless leg syndrome or sleep apnea, even though some pillows are marketed as solutions to snoring and sleep disorders. The only way to address sleep disorders, say both doctors, is to talk to your physician and get a proper diagnosis and treatment. Pillow IQ. Finding the right pillow is a matter of personal preference. You have plenty of options in today's high-tech era. Materials that conform to your shape, memory foam, help keep you cool, wick away moisture, or repel mold and dust mites, which may help allergy sufferers. Some pillows even track your sleep habits and wake you up with music. These can be pricey, in the hundreds of dollars. Traditional materials are also popular. Pillows made of down and feathers conform to your shape and repel dust mites, but they can be hot and expensive. Pillows made of cotton, wool, or synthetic cotton are less expensive, but they make it more attractive climate for dust mites. Keep firmness in mind. Side sleepers need a firm pillow for support. Rectangular pillows with panels on the side may help. They're taller than the standard pillows. Back and stomach sleepers may want to use a thinner, softer pillow. The goal is a comfortable position that will help you sleep. Try to get the spine in a relatively straight position, but everyone's recipe will be a little different, says Matthew O'Rourke, who's the physical therapist at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. Tips to help you embrace abdominal workouts. You can strengthen your abs without feeling like you're tackling a daunting workout. For some people, crunches and other abdominal muscle workouts are the last thing they want to do, so they don't. Part of the perception is that it's difficult. We tend to want to avoid doing things that require effort, especially as we get older, when that's harder for us, says Lorna Brown, a physical therapist who specializes in geriatrics at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital at Harvard. But skipping abdominal strengtheners can have a big effect on your mobility and independence, and not for the better. What are the abdominals? The abdominal muscles, often called the abs, include not just the visible six-pack or rectus abdominis muscles in the front of your abdomen, but also the obliques in the front and side of your abdomen and the transverse abdominis across your lower abdomen. The transverse abdominis is the inner muscle underneath the outer abdominal layers. It provides stability around the spine, Brown explains. The abs are part of your core, the collection of muscles that act as your foundation. In addition to your abs, your core includes the muscles along your spine, near your shoulder blades, in your hips and buttocks, and in your pelvis. Skipping ab workouts. You must work all your core muscles to stay strong and active. We need that strong core or base so that the arms and legs can perform well, Brown explains. What if you don't mind doing shoulder, hip, and back muscle exercises but can't stand the ab workout? You're putting your entire core in jeopardy. If your core isn't stable and strong, you increase the risk for injury and falls when you lift something or walk, Brown says. A weak core also makes it hard to turn, bend, and get dressed. A few ab tricks. Abdominal exercises don't have to include crunches, and you don't have to do a long ab workout. You may find it more palatable to sprinkle ab exercises throughout the day. Shorter bouts of exercise can still contribute to better health and function, Brown says. The key is to make each ab exercise count by activating the muscles. Can't think of ways to fit abdominal exercises into your schedule? Check out the Harvard Special Health Report. Quote, Gentle Core, which is located at www.health.harvard.edu/GC. And consider the following tricks. Watch TV from the floor. You probably did this when you were a kid. Try it now, and maybe you'll be more likely to do an ab exercise, like modified push-ups, leaning on your forearms instead of your hands. Or try lying on your back with your knees bent, suggests Brown. Then activate the abdominal muscles by drawing in your belly button toward the spine. Use phone time. Stand with your back flat against the wall while chatting on the phone. Activate your abs. Draw in your belly button again and push yourself against the wall, says Brown. Take a break from work. Whether you're in the kitchen or at the office, you can do a modified push-up against a desk or counter. Don't just stand there while you stand in line at the bank or grocery checkout. Do a single leg stand and slightly lift your leg off the floor while activating your core muscles, Brown suggests. Keep your chest high and your shoulder blades down and back. March in place. Next time you're brushing your teeth, march in place. Make it intentional. Draw in the abdominals and keep your hips level so they're not swiveling, Brown says. You can even activate the abdominal muscles while you're walking. Just be very intentional about it, says Brown. Think about posture and muscle activation with each step. The more often you activate your abs, the stronger they'll become, making ab workouts a lot less daunting. Move of the month, abdominal contraction. The starting position, kneel on all fours with your hands and knees directly aligned under your shoulders and hips. Keep your head and spine neutral. Movement. Exhale as you tighten your abdominal muscles by pulling them toward your spine. Keep your spine neutral so no arching your back. Hold. Release your abdominal muscles and return to the starting position and do this 8 to 10 times, then rest for 30 to 90 seconds. If you can, repeat the sequence. Tips and techniques, and there are two. First is this is a very subtle movement, and your spine should stay still throughout the exercise. And then breathe comfortably, exhaling as you pull your abdominal muscles in and up like a zipper. Get gut reaction, a limited role for digestive enzyme supplements. There's little evidence to support their use for common digestive distress like heartburn. Digestive enzyme supplements promise to fix everything from bloating and flatulence to heartburn and gut health. The supplements are so popular that global sales are expected to reach $1.6 billion by 2025, according to recent marketing research. But don't be too quick to reach for them. Some of them are clearly beneficial in certain situations, but enzyme supplements also are often used in situations where there is little evidence that they do any good, says Dr. Kyle Stoller, a gastroenterologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. What are digestive enzymes? They're naturally occurring digestive enzymes help break down food so we can soak up nutrients. Your mouth, stomach, and small intestine make some digestive enzymes. However, the majority come from your pancreas, which floods the small intestine when food arrives there with enzymes such as lipase, which breaks down fats, amylase, which breaks down carbohydrates, proteases, and peptidases, which break down proteins. Once nutrients are broken into small enough molecules, they're absorbed through the wall of the small intestine into the blood and then delivered throughout the body. Enzyme trouble. Sometimes the body doesn't make enough digestive enzymes. This can slow the digestion process and lead to uncomfortable symptoms. For example, if you don't make enough of the enzyme lactase, you'll have a hard time digesting lactase, the sugar in milk and milk-based products. If you don't have lactase, the undigested lactose goes to the colon, which leads to more fluid entering the colon and more gas produced by bacteria in the colon. That creates bloating, flatulence, and diarrhea, claims Dr. Stoller. Various health conditions can lead to low levels of digestive enzymes. Examples include cystic fibrosis, chronic pancreatitis, which is inflammation of the pancreas, and pancreatic cancer. Replenishing enzyme levels. Digestive enzyme replacement comes from two sources, prescription enzyme medications and over-the-counter supplements. Prescription enzymes such as Creon, Zenpep, and others contain pancrelipase, a mixture of the digestive enzymes amylase, lipase, and protease. and has a special coating on the pill so it will survive stomach acid and make it to the small intestine. These enzymes are typically made from the pancreases of pigs and are regulated and approved by the FDA. Over-the-counter digestive enzyme supplements available in health food stores and drug stores and on the Internet are not medications. The FDA does not regulate them. Therefore, you can't be sure what the pills are really made of or the exact amounts of enzymes they may contain. It's buyers beware, warns Dr. Stoller. The enzymes may come from animal pancreases, such as pig, cows, or lambs, or from plants. Common plant sources are fruit, molds, yeasts, and fungi. Examples include bromelain, derived from pineapples, papain, derived from papayas, and lactase, obtained from purified yeasts or fungi. When to use them? For people who can't make enough digestive enzymes because of a health condition such as chronic pancreatitis or cystic fibrosis, doctors prescribe enzyme pills to substitute for the lack of natural enzyme production. People with known deficiencies clearly get a benefit from the drugs, says Dr. Stoller. Taking a non-prescription lactase supplement such as Lactaid or Lactrase can help people manage lactose intolerance. And taking an alpha-galactosidase supplement such as Beano or Bean Relief may reduce gas and bloating if you have a hard time digesting the sugars in beans. But for other common gut problems such as heartburn or irritable bowel syndrome, there is little evidence that digestive enzymes are helpful. What you should do. Tests can measure the levels of some pancreatic enzymes in the blood, but these are used only to diagnose pancreatitis, not for a measurement of digestive function. Tests claiming to identify all enzyme deficiencies you may have aren't accurate, notes Dr. Stoller. But what if everything you've tried for digestion issues hasn't worked? And you'd like to try a digestive enzyme. Would it hurt? Well, in most cases, these are unlikely to be harmful, but I don't recommend spending a lot of money on them. And don't take them if you see signs of bleeding or if you see signs of a change in stool color. Report that to your doctor, says Dr. Stoller. Well, we will continue next time to talk about this really a very important topic, is stress making your allergies worse. And then five things to do this month include choose a pillow for your sleep position, take a quick break for abdominal exercise, take a yoga class, drink a cup of coffee, and add a cover to your steering wheel. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.